Welcome to Worlds Apart. From a special military operation to a state of war, the Kremlin's definition of hostilities on the Russian-Ukrainian border shifted starkly this past week following a gory attack on concertgoers outside Moscow. Is this switch in rhetoric likely to be followed by a change in military tactics? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Dmitry Trenin, research professor at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow and a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council. Mr. Trenin, it's always an exquisite pleasure, intellectual pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Oksana.
Now, throughout these last 2 years, you've written a lot about fear, the use and regulatory function of fear in international relations, for example, how it may encourage diligent risk calculation and healthy self-restraint. But here we are faced with a different kind of fear, terror to be precise, but it's also at some level rational. It aims at certain behavioral outcome. And I want to start by asking you, what do you think are the motives behind this attack?
Well, I think we are in the process of understanding this attack. I think that a lot of evidence so far suggests that the attack was aimed at wreaking, psychological havoc in Russia, essentially sending the message to the Russian people that Mr. Putin may have won the election, and yet he cannot fully guarantee security to Russian citizens, even in the capital of the country. I think that is one of the most important motives. Whoever was behind the attack, I think that was important. Another thing is that the attack was perpetrated by people coming from Tajikistan, and those who had planned the attack most probably wanted to worsen relations, inter-ethnic relations within Russia. You would remember a few months back there was an attempt to stoke inter-ethnic tensions in Dagestan over the arrival of a number of Jewish people from Israel, and that was clearly an attempt to destabilize the Northern Caucasus.
As you yourself know, and as you have just expressed, Russia is no stranger to either terrorist attacks or malevolent efforts to sow the discord within Russia. Having said that, I do want to ask you about the conduct and initial reaction to this attack, because, you know, there are certain things that are truly chilling here, and not just the number of victims. We have a handful of heavily armed men walking into a park concert hall, emptying their arsenals, without chanting any ideological or religious slogans, getting into the car and driving off along one of the busiest roads in the capital. I wonder if that in and of itself is meant or was meant to convey something, and if so, what and to whom?
Well, again, I think we're in the process of understanding what actually happened, why it happened, who was responsible, who was behind the attack. I think we know a lot right now, but the investigation continues. I think that what surprised me personally is the immediate reaction from the United States to the effect that this was an attack attributed to extremists of the Islamic State. And that I find very unusual. and hard to explain, except you point a finger to the United States immediately, as many people did, and I think that there's more evidence that this was something. This was potentially a false flag operation.
I definitely want to get to this question of attribution certainty on both sides, because I think it is pretty unusual to have an attack when, you know, at the time when it's committed, both sides are pretty confident about who has not committed it or who may have been behind. But before we go there, it's a very sensitive question, and I'm myself a Russian citizen. I live not far away from that mall, but I think it's an important question to ask to understand the dynamics, because the United States, as far as I understand, has warned its citizens not to go to any mass events and specifically avoid large gatherings, including concerts, on the eve of this attack. There was also some reports about them handing over some vague information about something possibly happening. And yet the Russian authorities did not change any levels of security in the capital. And this event was allowed to take place, perhaps because the Russian authorities wanted to convey this message of peace and stability within the country. And my question to you is pretty blunt. Do you think the Russian security services and law enforcement services also have to, you know, consider the way they operate, given that the country is indeed, you know, in a state of war, and yet we are still, at least in big cities, are trying to lead as normal of a life as possible?
Well, I think that, first of all, we don't know everything about the warning that the United States made. We can guess, but I don't think it was much, but and certainly I don't know what the actual reaction of the Russian authorities was to that message. I know that publicly Russian officials referred to those U.S. embassy statements as a way to, let's say, impact malevolently on the environment of pre-election Russia. I think that the way this war is conducted is meant to convey two messages at the same time, two very contradictory messages. One is that this is an existential matter. On the other hand, there's a very conscious attempt to allow people to continue living normal lives. Maybe I would explain that by the authorities' conclusion that the public, having spent the last many decades in peacetime, would not want to switch to wartime, and would not switch to wartime easily, and that would this switch could produce more problems. There's the reality of peace, maybe false reality, but you know, Moscow is, or many other, or all other cities except for Belgorod and maybe Kursk and maybe and clearly the cities like Donetsk and other cities in the new territories of Russia, they do not experience war firsthand. They saw things on television. They know that there's something going on, but their own lives do not feel the heat of the war.
From a PR point of view, it's understandable that the authorities would want to preserve, you know, some semblance of peace. But if you do not sort of help your public accustomed to the realities of the day, your enemies will do it for you. I mean, if people continue living as if they lived without the war, then don't you think that could be at a certain point more dangerous? Because the shock of a terrorist attack like we've just experienced would be, in this case, truly shocking. I mean, like, it's better to, I mean, the gap with reality in this case would be larger.
And my opinion is that we are at war. We have been at war for the past 2+ years. And we need to mobilize in different ways. I'm not talking about waves of mobilization of reservists. This is up to the commander-in-chief, up to the general staff to decide. But society needs to understand that peacetime is over for a period of time, maybe for a long period of time. And then we need to adapt more quickly and more effectively to the realities of the day. And unfortunately, this effort is not very much in evidence. And you see more people on the official side trying to create what you call the semblance of things staying normal. There's just something going on television screens. And there are volunteers collecting funds to help our soldiers on the front line. But otherwise, it's all normal. It's all nice. This is one thing. Another thing is you know, what kind of television content is appropriate during wartime? Because, you know, people were having good time in Moscow while thousands and thousands of their co-citizens were fighting, and many of them dying. And that is, that is a problem that needs to be resolved. Otherwise, I think you pointed it out yourself, otherwise we may have pretty serious problems later on. Someone has to tell the people that, well, guys, peacetime is over. We have this dire situation that will not go away by next Easter or by next Christmas or, you know, in the foreseeable future. We all need to carry our part of the burden. So this mentality needs to stop, and from all the way from top to bottom, that needs to change.
Okay, well, what needs to change right now, Mr. Trenin, is us taking a short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Dmitry Trenin, research professor at the Higher School of Economics in Moscow and a member of Russia's Foreign and Defense Policy Council. Now, Mr. Trenin, as we were talking before, as we were discussing before the break, fear and discomfort need to be managed not only outside, but also inside the country. Otherwise, your enemies may take an initiative upon themselves. But let's now talk about the international implications of what has happened. In the article that you wrote immediately after the attack, you posited that it may lead to serious changes in the nation's public security and foreign policy. And I'm sure you will tell me that it's too early to speculate, but still, what are the possibilities here on the international or foreign policy front?
This will be a very thorough investigation. No one is jumping to conclusions before that investigation is over, because everyone understands the stakes involved, and the conclusions that will be made will have to be translated into some real action. I think we're closing in on the final result of the investigation. We've heard very senior figures in the Russian security establishment, Mr. Bortnikov of the FSB, the Federal Security Service, and Mr. Patrushev, the Secretary of the Russian Federation Security Council. They both essentially pointed fingers at Ukraine, and in Mr. Bortnikov's case, also to the United States and the United Kingdom. And if this link to Ukraine and further on to the US and the UK is established, it's going to have practical consequences for the war. I think that with regard to Ukraine, we have also heard that that leadership of the Ukrainian security services may in fact be legitimate targets for Russian strikes. We have heard in the days after the terrorist attack that Russian missiles targeted buildings belonging to the Ukrainian security services. Right now, they have been, just in the last couple of days, they have been very major attacks against Ukrainian energy infrastructure. So the war has been ramped, the intensity of the war on the Russian side has been ramped up.
Now, as you yourself pointed out in that article, if the Ukrainian trail is confirmed, it would necessarily mean that an attack of this kind would not have been possible without some approval of the head of state, President Zelensky in this case. And as you mentioned in your article, at this point, Moscow is still abiding by its own sort of self-taken restraint of not targeting the Ukrainian president directly. But if the complicity of the Ukrainian leadership is indeed confirmed, that would not only make them legitimate targets, I suppose that would make them necessary targets. I mean, Russian security services, including the commander-in-chief, are by law obligated to take measures to defend Russian national security. And what I want to ask you about is, what's the, at this point, the larger geopolitical meaning or symbolism of this self-imposed constraint of not targeting Zelensky and his closest circle personally? And what would it mean to abandon this constraint?
Russia's war aims have been evolving since the start of the special military operation. You would recall the original terms of the treaty that was drafted, Russian-Ukrainian treaty that was drafted, but never signed. I think that if the connection between the terrorists and the Ukrainian security services is actually established in the Russian establishment, then not only will the Ukrainian leadership be seen as not under any circumstances not a party to any future talks, any future negotiations, but I think this will strengthen the view that quite a few people have been expressing openly, that Russia cannot not tolerate the Ukrainian regime, that Russia cannot afford living next to a terrorist state. So that state must go. And this would be, if that conclusion is reached, I'm talking about the conclusion of, about the connection, the Ukrainian connection, then this is the logical follow-up to that conclusion. If you're dealing with a bunch of terrorists who have captured the state, then that regime must go.
I'm not sure our audience understands the difference in military terms. What's the differentiation here? I mean, combating a terrorist state versus a conventional enemy state. How would the tactics change in this case?
Well, you know, in a war, you can decide to, at some point, you can decide to come to terms with your opponent. You have exhausted yourself. The opponent has exhausted yourself. You come to terms. You may or may not agree on a treaty, but at least some sort of an armistice. Look at Korea. Since 1953, there has been an armistice out there. No peace treaty, but no war either. So for some people in Russia, many people outside of Russia, the Korean scenario is at least a potentially possible scenario. And for some people, this is a desirable scenario. Now, I think this connection to terrorists would kill that scenario. Because you cannot seriously, if you're serious about yourself, if you're serious about your obligations as leaders of the state, etc., then you cannot tolerate living next door to a terrorist state. You have to smash it. You have to smash the regime and make sure that any future regime will be decent.
You've been an avid advocate of introducing fear more squarely and directly into the U.S.-Russian or U.S.-Western relationship and making it land in both Washington and London that they cannot wage a proxy war with Russia via Ukraine without no harm to themselves. And I think this sort of argument received some rhetorical support from the Russian leadership, but I didn't see it materialize into any straightforward action. If that link with Britain and the United States is established, either directly or, let's say, through intelligence channels, what could possibly be the Russian reaction? Because I think your point is very well taken that, you know, as Russia is being self-constrained in this war, the Western definitions of what is allowed keep moving and keep expanding. So how can Russia possibly stop that creeping process without initiating a larger, perhaps nuclear armed conflict?
Fear in the age of nuclear deterrence, fear is the best, maybe only guarantee that deterrence will not fail. And that the alternative to nuclear deterrence is nuclear war, very tragically. So I'm not a fearmonger. I'm just someone who is underlining the importance of something that lies at the heart of deterrence, and that's fear. If you have no fear, if you lose fear, then you should prepare for the worst.
Absolutely. I mean, even in basic psychology, fear is the necessary reaction. It actually keeps us alive.
This is the key ingredient in survival. And if we want to survive as a human race, then we must have a bit of fear when we, you know, deal with one another. I think that there's certainly, if it's established that the Ukrainian officials, beyond doubt, the Ukrainian officials were behind the attack, then, you know, the headquarters of the Ukrainian services, of the Ukrainian top leadership, need to become targets for the attack. It is also logical that, again, we only know about this promise not to target the Ukrainian president we only know about that from a foreign leader. Mr. Putin never told us that. But suppose former Prime Minister Bennett of Israel was right when he was saying what he was saying, that he understood Putin correctly, then this should this promise should be lifted.
But Mr. Trenin, again, would that be enough to for striking?
No,
fear not only in the hearts of Ukrainian leadership, but also sobering up Western elites who support that.
Western elites. I think there was an important statement from Director Naryshkin of the Foreign Intelligence Service, in which he said that if France decides to send soldiers into Ukraine, those soldiers will be wiped out. They will be priority targets for Russia. And I think that that is a serious warning, and that warning needs to be should not be ignored. Now, there are other things. I think that I don't know whether the Russian cruise missile entered the Polish airspace by chance, because of some miscalculation in mapping that flight, or maybe it was intentional. I think it's more likely that it was intentional. This is a message to our Polish neighbors that at some point there can be targets in Polish territory that will be engaged by Russian missiles. We're talking about supply points. We're talking about communications. We're talking about logistical routes leading to Ukraine. There are ladders of escalation. We're talking about the need for Russia. I'm talking the need for Russia to assume escalation dominance and not to be always on the receiving end, because being always on the receiving end would safely take us to an absolutely terrifying moment when there will be a choice between utter defeat of Russia or utter failure to achieve any meaningful results in Ukraine and nuclear war. I don't want us, all of us, to get there. So that we don't get there, we need to be more proactive and dominate the situation, because it's so much more important to us than it is for the United States, the United Kingdom, the rest of NATO, whoever. We need to assume domination in escalation there in order to achieve an early end on the conflict on conditions that would satisfy our security needs.
Absolutely. And I think your earlier point is also well taken. It's better to be scared than terrified or terrorized. Mr. Trenin, we have to leave it there, but as always, it's been great pleasure and honor for me to talk to you. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, Oksana. Thank you. Take care.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.